Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, May 11th, 2009. First item on the agenda is Senate Bill. Open a public hearing. Senate Bill 270. Senator Prozanski.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 270 is before you today, and one of the amendments that you're going to be asked to consider is the Dash 5 amendments. And the origin of the Dash 5 amendments really comes from a situation that's juvenile records that are used in different proceedings as to whether or not they should have confidentiality. The Juvenile Code under ORS Chapters 419A, B, and C gives different references as to how those records will be maintained and kept in confidentiality. Unfortunately, those chapters do not talk about if a case goes from the court of original court, such as the juvenile court or a circuit court, going up on appeal to the appellate court. And that's the concern that has been brought to my attention and why I asked for the Dash 5s to be drafted. There was a court decision that came out this past year question whether or not a record that is would be considered and has been in the practice as being considered confidential and not to be disclosed, whether or not those records would in fact be required to be disclosed once they get to the appellate courts. And in this case, I believe it's the Hamlin case in 2008 in December, Judge Brewer in his review interpreted the strict language of the statute to say that it did not include the cases that went before the appellate courts. So what we believe at this point is there's a need here to make sure and clarify what I believe all of us expected and anticipated. The juvenile records themselves that are generally considered confidential would in fact be confidential even though they may go from the trial court or the originating court level to the Court of Appeals or to the appellate court system. So in short, what the Dash 5s will do is follows. It will, one, clarify and keep the confidentiality of the juvenile records confidential when the juvenile case is on appeal. It will, in fact, codify that the decisions that are made by the appellate courts will not be confidential, that they will be disclosed. I should also mention that, of course, the proceedings that occur at the appellate level would be open to the public as well. And lastly, that the it would clarify that the appellate court records in a juvenile case would be and maintain confidentiality and that the court could, in good showing, consent to the disclosure when it is appropriate or necessary. That's the extent of the Dash 5s, Mr. Chair. And I do have a number of individuals, I believe, that have signed up that will be willing to come up and maybe answer some of the questions that may be for those that are certified smart as compared to myself.
Thank you. Any question for Senator?
Mr.
Chair, Olson.
So essentially, I mean, you're just allowing that door. I mean, if a juvenile moves up, that record stays with him and helps him along for the decision on the courts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, what we're trying to do is, I guess, clarify and make it clear in the statutes what all of us have felt and practiced, that a juvenile record itself is confidential and is not to be disclosed to the general public. Unfortunately, because the strictness of the language that was used in those four chapters, 419 A, B, and C, it has been interpreted now by the court that it does not include proceedings that move up the line into the appellate courts. And so we're not basically trying to create a new exception. We're just really wanting to make certain that what we have already believed to be the practice and is the practice up until this last end of last year.
Okay. Thank you.
And we have a few amendments, but you want Dash 5 to supersede everything else? That like a 2 and a 3 and
Mr. Chair, the 2 and the 6 are different amendments doing different things.
Okay.
This still happens to have a very nice relating to clause.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. So there's, this is one of those multiple use vehicles. And I'm only here speaking about the Dash 5.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bruce Miller and Angeli Sherbo.
Relating to courts. That's pretty broad.
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to present this Judicial Department bill. Before each legislative session, we solicit suggestions from our judges, trial court administrators, and staff for ways to improve statutes that deal with judicial administration, and this is the result of their input. We bring a bill like this each session. It has multiple changes in it. We put all of those into one bill to try to save on the expense and time involved in, that would be involved in having many separate bills to deal with this. This bill, in its current form, passed off the Senate floor 30-0. It passed out of Senate Judiciary without objection. You can break the bill down into three basic areas. The first is emergencies, the second is process for fees, and the third is on judgments. So I'd like to take a minute and take you through the bill so you have a general flavor of what it's about. The first section deals with Chief Justice's authority to promulgate rules regarding emergencies. We thought it was important to put something into statute on this. Because as we've found with the various court emergencies we've had over the last 3 or 4 years, there's a big impact on the parties and their rights to file lawsuits and the impact that has on the statute of limitations. So we're putting this into statute with specific reference to the ORCP and the statute that deal with extending the statute of limitations. Section 2 is a related matter regarding the administrative authority of the presiding judges. Currently, the Chief Justice has the authority to delegate his administrative authority to the state court administrator. There is not a corresponding authority in statute for the presiding judges. And what we found, especially in the December 07 storm on the North Coast, that was a big problem because judges and court personnel were isolated without a means of communication, and it was difficult to get things done without that administrative authority. This section would allow the presiding judge to delegate his administrative authority either to another judge or to the trial court administrator. The next area in the bill is process on fees and that type of thing. Section 3 deals with collection fees. As I'm sure you all know, the Judicial Department is supposed to charge for costs on collections. One of the things that we get to charge for is the costs that are incurred by the Department of Revenue and private collection agencies once we refer a case out for collection. Occasionally, when we refer a case out for collection, we continue to have costs afterwards. It doesn't happen all that often, but it does happen occasionally. And this change is meant to allow us to recapture that cost as well. Section 4 deals with motion fees. Currently in statute, when a party files a petition or complaint, they need to pay their filing fee at the same time that they file their petition or complaint. There is not similar language in the statute regarding motion fees. This simply clarifies that when a party files the motion that's subject to a fee, they have to pay their fee at that time. Section 5 deals with sheriff's fees. A number of our counties have had long-standing arrangements with their sheriffs to collect the sheriff's fees when a party comes in and files a lawsuit. When the waiver and deferral statutes were rewritten last session, there was a technical change to the wording that we think would make it difficult or impossible for us to continue with that particular setup that we have with the sheriffs, and it's very beneficial to the sheriffs. They want us to be able to collect their fees for them. So this is a technical change to the wording in the statute so that we can continue to collect those fees and continue on with our agreements that we have with sheriffs in various counties. And I think that leads us into the next segment, which is judgments. The judgment is the most important document that a prevailing party can get in a lawsuit. In 2003, the judgment statutes were rewritten and consolidated into Chapter 18. And since then, we have had to have various amendments over the last few sessions to pick up things that weren't picked up in the original rewrite of the judgment statutes. One of the problems we've seen is that parties become confused on when to use a supplemental judgment and what to put into it. If you think of it as a tiered system, a party can get a limited judgment before the case is over. They can get a general judgment when the case is over. They can get a supplemental judgment if something new comes up after the case is over. This clarifies that if you get a supplemental judgment, the only things that can be in it are things that are new over the general judgment. And then that way you don't run into problems when people file liens and, you know, was it doubled up in the supplemental judgment or not. It's something to help the parties and help the courts understand what the document is in front of them. After this bill passed out on the Senate side, the Department of Justice discovered something that they thought might cause them some problems with child support collection efforts. So we sat down with them and worked on an amendment to take care of their concerns on that, and that's the Dash 2 amendment. We're not taking a position on that amendment. We don't have an objection to it, and we think that it does correct their problem, and we also think that it won't have an impact on what we're trying to accomplish here. The next area where there's confusion with judgments is in the garnishment area. So Section 7 goes into the garnishments and tries to make it a little more clear as to when a party should seek a supplemental judgment. It should almost always be a supplemental judgment when there was an underlying case, because there should have been a general judgment there. There can be other types of garnishments where there won't be a general judgment, and so it would be labeled either as a limited or a general judgment. It's a technical cleanup to try to guard parties so once again they label their document properly. Section 8 deals with accusatory instruments. The way the statute is written right now, when an accusatory instrument is dismissed, it's dismissed by an order. A judgment is meant to be the final action in a case. And the way this statute is written, the order is the final action in the case because it's dismissed the accusatory instrument. So it's just a technical change to call that a judgment rather than an order so that it complies with the framework that's been set up for judgments. Section 9 is a conforming amendment to that same problem with the accusatory instruments. And on to our RONCO, and that's not all section of the presentation. The Dash 6 amendments are from the department. This is an issue that a judge brought to us in the last month or so after the bill came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Under the current statutory scheme, ORS 10.030 deals with when a felon can sit on a jury. The Constitution deals with when a misdemeanor can or cannot sit on a jury. And we found that that caused some confusion as the judge and parties went to look at the statute, and it talked about felons but not misdemeanors, and we felt it might be best to conform the statute with the Constitution so that it's all in one place for both the parties, courts, and counsel, so that they can look at that statute and get guidance on how to deal with jurors who may be felons or misdemeanors. And then the last amendment is Dash 5 from Senator Prezansky. He covered the amendment well. The only thing I would point out is that we are neutral on the bill because this is a policy decision for the legislature. We did participate in the work group that worked on the amendment. We believe that we have the amendment in a proper position to work for everyone concerned. The opinions of the appellate courts will continue to be public. They will be released to the for all to see. The court will continue its current practice of using initials to identify natural parties rather than using their names as a part of the effort to preserve confidentiality. And I think that was it on that one. So thank you for your time.
Any questions?
Please. My name is Angela Sherbo. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I am also consulting with the Office of Public Defense Services on an appellate unit representing parents in juvenile court. I and my co-supervising attorney together have over 60 years of experience with juvenile court proceedings. We supervise 17 people and have something like 1,500 juvenile cases going in our office at any one time. So I have the dubious pleasure or distinction, I would say, of having reviewed many, many, many juvenile court files. I know what's in them. I know how sensitive that material is, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that and then come back to what the bill does in terms of protecting that. Much of the material that's filed in the juvenile court relates to not only what's happened in the past, which is in a normal civil litigation, but also what might happen in the future. There are psychological evaluations. There are very sensitive and intrusive psychosexual evaluations. The material in the files is not only, it's intertwined, it's all with respect to the history and prognosis of the child, because that's what the proceeding is about. But you will find material in there about parents. You will find material in there about relatives, grandparents, aunts, uncles, foster parents, providers. So it's an extremely sensitive and throughout the state very different set of materials that is covered now when it's at the juvenile court by ORS 419A-255. What the Dash 5 amendments do essentially, and not to oversimplify it, is to say when that material moves and crosses the mountains from Prineville and lands in Salem or comes up the highway from Medford and lands in Salem, nobody who expected those materials to be private is going to be harmed because now all of a sudden they're public. And what the bill does is it corrects what I believe to be an oversight in drafting some many years ago, because I think it has always been the policy of this legislature that the private matters of children who had absolutely no choice in being brought into court, these aren't civil litigants who made a choice to pursue their differences in a proceeding that's public, were meant to remain private. I can answer any other questions. Let me say two other things. Many of those materials are also made confidential and or privileged by a variety of other state statutes and by a number of federal statutes. All of the special education material relating to children that are in those juvenile court files are covered and protected by the IDEA. Regular general education materials in those files are covered by FERPA, the Federal Education Rights and Privacy Act. HIPAA protects many of the physical and mental health materials in those files. There are special provisions to protect the mental health and drug and alcohol records. So it's an extraordinarily complex area. We have a statute in place which expresses the policy of the legislature that that's meant to be private. I believe that the Court of Appeals correctly analyzed the statute to not cover, as it was written, the Court of Appeals. And what the proponent of these amendments, and I support that, is essentially trying to do is say the practice was such that these were protected whether they sat in Salem or they sat in Portland, and we need to conform the statutes to that practice and continue to protect the children and the families. And lastly, I would say I expect that were this not to be adopted, it would have an extremely chilling effect both on parents and children's willingness to participate in those kinds of intrusive evaluations and people's willingness or desire to appeal from something that may be an absolutely erroneous decision. Thank you so much.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Teresa Bottomley, Andrea Meyer, and Tammy Wood. You can go in any order. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Therese Bottomley, Managing Editor of the Oregonian. I'm responsible for legal affairs at the newspaper, working with our attorneys on issues of open courts and public records. I urge you to reject secrecy in Oregon's courts and support openness and transparency whenever possible. Every year, the Oregonian spends untold thousands of dollars working to open court rulings and documents for public inspection. Unfortunately, the area of juvenile court cases and juvenile services are areas that are rife with problems, as we all know. And in many cases, the need for watchdogging in those areas is greater than any other. Also, secrecy in many cases does not serve the public interest in those cases. Even now, as we're talking today, the Oregonian is still trying to open up the judge's ruling in the Adriana Cram case, a case you're probably familiar with, where a little girl from Oregon was sent to Mexico, where she was abused and killed. In that case, we still do not have the judge's order that sent her to Mexico. We have no idea what sort of oversight was ordered, what sort of conditions were placed on her movement to foster care there. It is our belief that any document filed in any court that forms the basis of a court's adjudication must be available to the public. Adjudication is the key word. Once a document is filed with the court and the court is asked to make a decision based on that document, then it becomes part of the adjudication process. Oregon's Constitution is clear. No court shall be secret. It does not say no court except for juvenile court proceedings shall be secret. The Oregonian established this in the landmark case Oregonian Publishing versus Diaz. That case is why our reporters can sit in juvenile court and listen to proceedings just as any member of the public can. Any of the sensitive information earlier referenced before this committee can and does come out in those proceedings. The constitutional command would mean very little if a judge could issue decisions without letting the public know the facts or evidence on which he or she based the decision. The need for transparency in a juvenile matter is even greater, it seems to me, when a child's future is involved. The Court of Appeals case that started all this is an example of how the courts can have openness but still address the need for confidentiality. That case is titled In the Matter of M.H., a Minor Child. The full name is State X. Rel. Juvenile Department of Clackamas County, Appellant v. C.H. and R.H. Respondents. So we do understand the need for some degree of confidentiality. But nowhere in its discussion of this case does the Court of Appeals identify the parties involved, yet transparency is achieved as far as its decision-making. In fact, we only know the names of those involved because of a related criminal matter. And I would note that in criminal cases that involve juveniles, the courts use full names of defendants, witnesses, and the like. And in civil cases, much of the information referenced before, the sensitive information in those files, does also become public. There was no such thing as juvenile court in 1857 when the Constitution was written. All juvenile proceedings were held in regular courts open to the public. It makes little sense to make proceedings that are open now in juvenile court and the fuller context behind those proceedings secret once they reach the appellate courts. I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that any statute that attempts to keep secret the adjudication of any matter in Oregon courts would fly in the face of Article 1, Section 10. No court shall be secret, but justice shall be administered openly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm a little bit curious. How would you answer some of the concerns about the sexual, psychological writings and so on? In the juvenile, you know, court, the main goal is to try to help somebody get through that, a kid grow out of whatever it is. And so their concern is that if you put that in the front page of the paper, they may never, you know, be able to correct whatever that is, or it'd be so humiliating or whatever.
Thank you, Chair. I think the distinction here that I'm trying to make is that the proceedings must be open and the adjudication must be open, but there can be built in some degree of confidentiality for the individual juvenile involved. So in a case where we're using initials to identify the child, that would be acceptable. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Stigler.
Ms. Mattingly, is it your contention that the proposed provisions of the Dash 5 amendments are inconsistent with the current state of juvenile court procedure as set out in Chapter 419 with respect to the trial stage of the proceedings?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Rep. Stigler, they are consistent, as I understand it, with what is in place for juvenile court records. But as I said, juvenile court proceedings, where some of this information would come out to the public, are open to our reporters and to the general public.
Okay. Follow-up,
please.
But that's my point. The provisions of the Dash 5 amendments are not inconsistent currently with Chapter 419 as it relates to records and or the proceedings and what can be released. It mirrors that.
That's my understanding. Okay. But I do believe that they're inconsistent with Judge Brewer's ruling, which opens up much more of that court file. And in the case of the amendment as written, many things are listed in there that would be prohibited from being public, which I believe should be public. In, for instance, motions, judges' orders, anything short of a decision, and so you're left with a situation where you could get a ruling from the Court of Appeals and have literally no basis whatsoever, no motions along the way, nothing upon which to view that decision in its larger context.
Okay, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I want to understand exactly what your argument is, because first of all, I would agree with your analysis. Yes, the proposed Dash 5 amendment is indeed wholly inconsistent with Judge Brewer's ruling, largely because the purpose of this amendment in large part is to reverse Judge Brewer's ruling. So, yes. So, I think you're saying either one of two things, or perhaps both. That either A, the existing privacy scheme under 419A, 255, and 257 is unconstitutional, or B, that it's bad public policy, or perhaps both. Either way, it doesn't seem that either question is really at issue directly anyway with the proposed amendment.
I'm not sure that 419, that I would say sweepingly, is bad public policy. We have come before the legislature to try to make adjustments to 419 when we think the public interest is better served by more openness. And we did achieve that in the cases where a child in state custody was severely injured or killed, that DHS would release documents in that case. That was a key provision of the watchdogging that we feel we must do. And so there are times I believe 419 works perfectly. There are times when I believe even under 419 we need more openness for the Oregonian and for the public to be the watchdog of state agencies. Again, as far as where we would like to end up, what we want is that the courts operate openly. I do believe that there is a greater... they're going to the Court of Appeals for review because there is a concern on someone's part that something didn't go right. The law was not properly applied. Decisions were not properly made. There is a check and balance there. And what we need is to be able to see, once the court rules, what that ruling was based on. And as you know, the ruling could be one sentence. And in that case, how does the public know whether or not that is a good ruling or a bad ruling because they have nothing to base it on?
Further questions? Okay, thank you, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tammy Wood. I'm with the Linn County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here for the Linn County Sheriff. I'm also the president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Command Council, and so I'm here also representing the sheriffs across the state. Two of my colleagues were unable to attend today, so I guess I drew the short straw and brought their written testimony to you, and I will try to summarize it for you. The sheriffs do oppose Senate Bill 270 as it's currently written. The courts have had a longstanding practice of waiving sheriff's service fees, and we don't have any opposition to codifying that into law as it relates to 21410 subsection 1A. But section 5 of this bill allows the court to waive funds that we collect under 21410 subsection 1B. And these are sums that are reasonable and necessary to secure a keeper or custodian of property, the expenses we incur in inventorying the property, and expenses in newspaper advertising. These things are items that are currently waived by the court, and they're really not fees. They're our expenses. We incur these when we seize and sell property under execution, and we when we hire movers, tow trucks, boarding and feeding animals, those kind of expenses. And these can range into the thousands of dollars. These expenses are recoverable when the property is sold. However, there's no guarantee that the property will make it to the sale, or there's no guarantee that they'll sell at a price high enough to cover those costs. There are several reasons why the property wouldn't be sold. One would be a challenge to execution, in which a third party goes before the court and gets a ruling that the property is not the debtor's and instead belongs to the third party. The debtor can file a claim of exemption and obtain a court ruling that the property is exempt from sale totally, or that there's a set amount that it's exempt. The debtor can also file bankruptcy, in which case we have to hold the property, often for prolonged periods of time, while we wait for a ruling from the federal courts. And we can also get stays, and the court would direct us to hold it pending further litigation. I have witnessed this occur in my own office, and I know it has occurred all over the state. So we don't oppose the current practice of waiving our sheriff's service fees under 21410 subsection 1A, but we don't have the budget to pay for debt collection under 21410 1B. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you and would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Captain Wood, for being here. So none of the amendments take care of that situation for the sheriffs?
Chair and Representative Cameron, no, they don't.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain, was these arguments made in the Senate?
Chair and Representative Wisniewski, we didn't catch this bill until it had already passed the Senate.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU, and after 5 months, I finally got the sore throat, so I'm going to excuse my voice today. I am here today on behalf of the ACLU to speak about the Dash 5s and join the Oregonian expressing our concerns and objections. And I realize that, yes, this does reflect an advancement of the same policy that relates to the trial court. But we do think and want to raise a concern for you that whole statutory scheme is vulnerable to a constitutional challenge under Article 1, Section 10, which does provide that no court shall be secret, but justice shall be administered openly and without purchase, completely and without delay. And as Ms. Bottomley spoke, it is the court's decision and the documents upon which it relied that is the critical importance of having our open courts. And I do appreciate the tension and the issues before you in this statute and in the underlying issues. We have a constitution that sometimes states things quite explicitly and in manners that any given day none of us are completely satisfied with. But it is a dynamic, and I think this whole statutory scheme really needs to be looked at with a large work group during the interim, because I think this is a matter of time before the courts may get this question, and then we've unraveled a lot of things. You heard mention, as Ms. Bottomley already testified about, you know, no secret decisions, and that the judge's ruling in the Cram case, the horrific case we've heard about in this building and other hearings with the young girl, I mean, the judge's ruling has not even been made available, and that just is counter to secret court and not having secret courts. I've only quickly looked at the Dash 5s, and there's language at the end of this, as there were language at the end of the Dash 4s regarding one exception to this, which would be, and I don't believe this has changed, but I stand to be corrected, that the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court's judgments would be available. But I want to caution, that is the judgments, but not the order of the court. So, for instance, in the very case that brings us here today, what was being sought, and I just briefly, it was the issue around Clackamas County Court ordering that a parent be released so that the child would not go into foster care. The parent was arrested. There's criminal proceedings, and the state didn't want to have to pay for that or be charged with that duty, and as such, I believe the state appealed the court's order. In turn, the Court of Appeals entered an order on the motion, an order making a decision about what would happen in that case that had become very public. That order would still not be available to the Oregonian or anyone else to understand what happened there and the decision of the Court of Appeals. I mean, we would have a secret decision by the Court of Appeals because it is an order rather than a judgment in the underlying proceedings. So it does raise concerns. Again, members of the committee, I understand the situation and the tensions here and the factors that you need to consider. We respect that. We do just want to alert that we think there's a constitutional traffic collision at some point in the future, and we really do need to address this big issue before the courts make a further ruling. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've both made a very important point, but I think we need to adopt the Dash 5 for the sake of consistency in the court system. It seems to me if we don't adopt the Dash 5, we're still going to have to take this issue up in a work group in the interim. I would rather do that, having adopted the Dash 5 and established consistency from the trial to the appellate court levels.
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I understand the situation you're in. I would certainly want you to consider strongly whether, in terms of what the Court of Appeals will and will not release, being limited to a judgment seems very problematic. We don't have open courts in the Court of Appeals. I mean, part of the issue is, you know, in our trial courts, they are open courts, so everyone can attend and you can witness what's going on and hear a court order, hopefully, although there are still some situations where the court is not even providing the order. But we're adding to a current problem by limiting it to judgment, and while I'm think that doesn't go to fixing the underlying issue, I would want to raise that as a particular concern to this version of the proposal. I know the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court issue, you'll hear tons of orders, but when they make an order on an issue that is a public concern, and I know the law gives them the ability to release that, but we all know that Clackamas County Manor was a public concern, and the reason we have Judge Brewer's decision is because they wouldn't release the Court of Appeals order. So when we had a matter of public concern, and it was clearly, everyone, you know, public concern prior to the Court of Appeals getting involved, they still could not get it. And that belies the idea that the public interest will outweigh in those situations, and we can trust that we will get those documents when necessary, unfortunately.
And then I could kind of ask a question, maybe, Ms. Bromley. So at the present time, you're allowed to go into the court proceeding part of it. And so do they have, is this information about the psychological evaluation and so on, that must be heard in the courtroom as well. And so what's the procedure? Does the judge say, please don't print that, or?
Chair, thank you for the question. No, anything that is said in the open court proceeding is able to be published. Newspapers always use discretion. We don't identify victims of sexual abuse unless they come forward and want their story to be told. We are very cognizant of sensitive issues involving juveniles. In some cases, even when there's been criminal activity, we don't identify juveniles by name, and that's pretty common practice across newspapers.
And in today's shift with the bloggers who claim to be newsmen, I've seen they're having different places. So somebody with no scruples whatsoever could go in and really blow something like that wide open. Would that be correct?
Any member of the public can attend juvenile court proceedings.
Chair Barker, if I can add to that, it isn't a media exception to coming in, so it wouldn't be these bloggers who are defining the media. This is already anyone could. So to the degree that we've had abuse or not a record of abuse, we have the history showing, and so it's not a change in the broadening of media and the methods of communication out there.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bird, did you have a question?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you also for your testimony. This is a genuinely interesting issue, and I do concede that there are some competing tensions. That said, I think I've argued as forcefully as anyone on this committee that, A, we need to take a look at public records law in Oregon. We're creating exceptions and then exceptions to the exceptions, and it is an appropriate topic for our work group. That said, I'm deeply skeptical that your argument that essentially 419.255, although certainly subject to a colorable constitutional challenge, I'm very skeptical that it's subject to a facial constitutional challenge, perhaps as applied, for example, in a specific circumstance. But, I mean, the rights, the public interest rights that you guys have described are not absolute. We routinely bend them, for example, filing things under seal. It's certainly not absolute. And so I plan to support the dash 5 months.
Chair Barker, Representative Burton, I understand. I do want to clarify so that we know, because I think we can think of this as both a public records, but this isn't. So when we talk about the exemptions to the public records, which ACLU has significant concern, we're talking not about court cases necessarily. Sure. We're talking about the broad range of public records. Here, we're really talking about the open court and what transpires inside the court. And so records that...
And,
you know,
and Mr. Chair, I did conflate the two just now, which was probably confusing.
I knew you know your Article 1, Section 10.
I apologize. I didn't mean to.
But I just want to make clear that's the basis by which we think there might be a constitutional vulnerability only to this situation of the open courts dynamic. And I know Representative Siegler is waiting. And I'm not here testifying that it is unconstitutional. I'm here saying that we believe, and it will be challenged, I believe, and we would hate to see it happen in a way that we can't deal with it in a manner appropriate.
Chair and Rep. Barton, if I could answer as well. I would just like to add that 419 does not stretch into the criminal cases, and so you already have a case where anything that's in place under 419, once it goes into the criminal courts arena, all bets are off. Documents are not then secret, and indictments use full names, and witnesses are identified by their full names. And I would also say that, you know, Judge Brewer's ruling is January. We're in May. I have seen no harm. I mean, I have no example of any harm that's come from the situation under Judge Brewer's ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to beat a dead horse, but I guess I just want to harken back to Ms. Meyer. You described a situation under which records weren't released and the matter, you know, crawled up through the appellate process. That's exactly why we have the appellate process. Wouldn't you agree?
Chair Barker, Representative Siegler, the record release wasn't being litigated from the trial court, or it is in CRAM, and that's not where involved. If you're speaking about the Clackamas County,
yeah.
The Clackamas County situation, the state appealed the court's decision. There was no open court public records dynamic. It was once the Court of Appeals had it, the Court of Appeals then issued an order. Issue instructing, because they appealed the judge's decision. That order, that decision by the Court of Appeals, a document ordering, making this decision was not public, was not available under the open courts. So we have what is, in a way, a secret court. They took an action in a case and didn't.
But that decision would be available.
No, I believe, Representative, that is an order in a decision, not a judgment. And that's what I was trying to point out is my previous reading of the dash 4, and I believe it still, it says any decision, but it's defined by ORS 1940-450, and that's why I want to make sure, because it before had said any judgment, and I think 1940-450 may just be still is a judgment. But that's what I was trying to distinguish between a judgment, because I was sat in a meeting about this.
Let me just clarify. It refers to a decision pursuant to, I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing here, as defined in 19.450, and a decision means a memorandum opinion, an opinion indicating an author, or an order denying or dismissing an appeal issued by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. The decision shall state the court's disposition of the judgment being appealed and may provide for final disposition of the cause. The decision shall designate the prevailing party or parties, state whether a party or parties will be allowed costs and disbursements, and if so, by whom the costs and disbursements will be paid.
So
that is releasable.
And my only question is that an order on a motion versus an order part of a judgment? And
okay.
I'm not sure... I think the language, and, you know, maybe council has a chance, but the earlier version, and in the work group they talked about, they said, no, it's just a judgment. We are not going to do orders in motions.
Now, it says decision, so I'm going to have to refer to what it references.
And if it's been broadened, I'd love to hear from the proponents that they now have decided to include from the dash fours to the dash. I was told there was very little change in the language, and I certainly, ACLU had raised this dynamic in the meeting that we
understand. I understand that. But you would agree as well, however, that this mirrors specifically what the juvenile code currently does with respect to records in the juvenile court arena.
I feel like I'm on the witness stand. Yes, no, Your Honor, I think we've made that clear that
okay.
This just continues.
I just want to be very clear about that. And there have been opportunities over the past. The current juvenile provisions have been in play for a long time.
And I think the courts will sooner rather than later, in light of what's going on in the CRAM matter and in this matter, be potentially looking at it. And Judge Brewer portends a...
But I just want to be really clear. We're not going beyond what the current status of the law is.
Well, Chair Barker, Representative Siegler, you are, because, one, the current law didn't apply to the Court of Appeals. Two, you're adding a judgment order issue here that was not, and you may know better, but I don't know that judges' orders on motions and other things are closed in those cases. But, of course... We aren't going to status quo, as someone said, because the status quo is that these are part of a public, but open court.
This mirrors
something. Chair Barker,
thank
if
you.
I may.
Please.
Just to answer that, Rep. Stigler, I would say that this does go farther in terms of secrecy because of that very amendment I talked about, where we were able to get into the statute that in cases where a child were severely injured or dies within state custody, that documents shall be made public. In this case, a court case involving a severely injured or killed child would be secret under this. So again, all of the material in the file would be secret when by statute some of that would be open.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I must say I'm sympathetic to the notion that we need to have more eyes rather than fewer eyes paying attention to our juvenile dependency proceedings, despite the respect I certainly have for the Juvenile Rights Project and Ms. Sherbo, because I think if the public truly knew what was happening on a typical day in our juvenile dependency cases, they'd be horrified, whether it's the caseloads of the lawyers who are representing the kids, to the quality of foster care, to the number of kids that are left in homes because there's no adequate foster parents to homes to put them in. My question, though, is... This is coming to us quite late. We're asked to make a pretty weighty decision on a Dash 5 amendment that could affect the ability to pass this entire bill. What would, and perhaps not for the opponents, because they might have a point of view on it, but what would be the problem of holding off on this until February? Would there be a major impact to the public good on this? Council, I guess.
Senator Shields, Chair Barker, you're asking if Senate Bill 270 as a whole doesn't pass?
No. If we did not adopt the Dash 5s, what would be the results?
I think that would kind of be speculative. I know that several people are very concerned about this decision, but as Ms. Bottomley said, she hasn't seen any fallout from the decision yet, so it's really hard to say.
So would it basically be that some of these records would remain in the public realm until we addressed it in February?
And it would only affect the decisions that are getting appealed, obviously. So there's a small universe, I imagine, that I don't know.
And I also would say, I'm hearing a lot of people say, we'll take care of that in February. That's a short month. That's going to be, I don't know, you're getting a lot of promises being made on what will be done. Representative.
Although I said sure. I would support the Dash 5, and I think I still will, I do think that there's potentially an issue here, as Ms. Meyer has said, about the judgment versus an order on a motion. Mm-hmm. I would like us to perhaps hold this for a couple of days to look at that, and maybe that can give us more time to think about what action we take.
We'll not be working the bill today. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 270. Yeah, on 306. Is she still here?
Yeah.
open a public hearing on Senate Bill 306.
Let me give a little intro.
Senator Bonamici, I apologize.
Very interesting, Mr. Chair.
That's right, you're aware.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm wondering if you miss us down here.
I do. I miss you very much, Representative. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, and it's good to be back in the House Judiciary Room, where I have many fond memories of spending many hours in this room, along with several of you. I'm here to testify today in support of Senate Bill 306A, and I want to tell you how I came to be involved with this bill, because you will see that my name is not on the bill as a sponsor. What had happened was I had a constituent come to me who's a practitioner in a Portland law firm about this same issue. He mentioned that this statute had not been updated for many years, and he asked me to if I would consider drafting a bill. So I put my bill request into legislative council, and I got a letter back from our keen-eyed legislative council, who explained that there was already a bill that dealt with part of the situation, which was the tort part, and then my bill would have dealt with both of them. So in the interest of government efficiency, we amended my portion into the existing bill. So we have one bill that started out as what would have been two. And Mr. Chair and committee, the purpose of this bill, Senate Bill 306A, is really to encourage the early settlement of small cases. And what happens is, under current Oregon law, a plaintiff can recover attorney's fees under a small contract and tort action by requiring the defendant to pay the attorney's fees if the plaintiff receives a judgment greater than the amount the defendant offered after receiving a formal written demand from the plaintiff. And the statute has really served its purpose since it began, but for the past 10 years, a small case has been defined as those seeking $5,500 or less, and so it hasn't been updated in the past decade. If you think about 10 years ago, how different things were and how things have changed, and in my written testimony, I have a few reasons why I believe that the amount should be updated. What happened on the Senate side, Mr. Chair and Representatives, is that our good chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who you heard from just a while ago, after the first public hearing on this, he asked the proponents and the opponents to get together and talk about some of the concerns that were raised. What you see before you in the amended version is a result of those discussions. And what happened was there were some compromises made. And one of them is that there's a current 10-day period. That was to give the defendant more time to evaluate the claim. That was increased. In fact, it was doubled to 20 days. So now there's a 20-day time period to evaluate the claim so the defendant can decide if they're going to make the settlement offer. But also, importantly, there's a new provision in the statute that hasn't existed before, and that's a provision that requires the plaintiff to turn over to the defendant not just a demand letter, but the underlying documentation of the claim, whether it be a tort claim or a contract claim. And that will give the defendant more information on which to base the settlement offer. So that has never been done before. That's new in this version of the bill, which I support and supported both in the committee and on the Senate floor, Mr. Chair, because I believe that this really turns out to be a better situation, because you have a longer time period for the defendant to consider whether to make a settlement offer, and you have the underlying documentation. And Mr. Chair and committee, that obligation continues. It isn't just you turn over what you have at day one. If the plaintiff has additional information, medical bills or further information that would support the claim, they need to turn that over to the defendant as well during that 20-day time period. So the overall result, Mr. Chair and committee, is that more cases will settle, fewer lawsuits will be filed, and if the plaintiff makes an unreasonably high demand, then he or she will not be awarded attorney fees, and if the defendant ignores a legitimate demand, then they'll be required to pay the claim plus the attorney's fees. So we heard in the Senate there was a lawyer from Albany, Mr. Nelson, James Nelson, and I don't know if he's here today, but he said the statute really works. He's been on representing both sides of the issue, and he said it really has reduced litigation by encouraging fair settlements of smaller claims. And one of the things that I wanted to point out finally, Mr. Chair, is that they've had a $10,000 limit in or amount in a similar statute in Washington for years, and that has worked very well. So, Mr. Chair, this bill was designed to update the amount in the statute before commencement of an action, but it also was expanded to result in what I think is a better situation that gives more information and more time to the defendants to evaluate their claims. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee. It's nice to be back here and happy to present this testimony. And I'd be more than willing to try to answer some of the questions, depending on who asks them.
I have one. So if I'm the injured party and I send you some documentation, I've been to the chiropractor, car accident, and I ask you for $8,000. In the meantime, I'm continuing going to my doctor. And so on day 19, I send you some more things and say, well, I really need $10,000. But my first claim was $8,000. That's the claim we're arguing about. So with the new evidence, the court then says, we're going to award you $8,100. Then I'm entitled to attorney's fees, even though, I mean, how does that work?
I've
seen the shifting of with this time of this 20 days. Mm-hmm. When does that stop? When does the offer stop and become the number?
Chair, I'm going to take a stab at that, although my law degree is much dustier than that of several of the members on your committee who will probably do a better job at this. But it would be my understanding that you wouldn't submit the demand until you had a better idea of what your damages would be. Representative Barton shaking his head. Yeah. I hope that's right. And, no. And hopefully that other proponents can correct me if I'm wrong when they come up. But that would be my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Senator.
Representative
Barton shakes his head both ways.
Yes, I do, Representative.
Chair and Representative Krieger, I won't try to interpret what that means, but I'll leave that up to you.
We haven't figured it out yet either.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your attention, and I encourage you to send this bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I believe it will help settlement of small claims.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Neil Jackson, Kevin Crawford, and Jim Nelson, please. Eric Glasser, you can pull a chair up too if you'd like.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association in support of Senate Bill 306. I'm not going to go through my whole list because Senator Bonamici did a heck of a job of laying out what this statute does. And I have had the opportunity to talk to a number of you prior to this committee meeting. The statute was originally adopted, RS 20.080, was actually originally adopted by the legislature in 1947. And the court cases that have interpreted since then have repeatedly said, and as recently as December of last year, in the Powers versus Quigley case, the court reiterated the purpose of the statute. The purpose of the statute is to make sure that plaintiffs don't overvalue their cases when they make these demands, and to make sure that defendants look at these cases and make a real fair evaluation of the case in order to prevent the lawsuit from being filed and being subject to attorney's fees. Since 1947, the statute has worked, and it's worked well. As Senator Bonamici said, the statute that you have before you, 306A, is a result of a work group compromise where OTLA got together with OADC. Mr. Crawford is here today on their behalf, and we basically went down a list of problems that they had seen with the statute, had dealt with, and do deal with the statute, and we acknowledged that there were some problems. We acknowledged that there were attorneys out there that were sending these demand letters, only giving the defendant 10 days to respond and not providing one piece of paper of proof. These attorneys would get called up by claims adjuster, by the defendant's attorney, and say, hey, show me something. I mean, you say you got this claim. Show me something. And some of these, we call them bad apples, were saying, I don't have to. The statute says I don't have to. And I'm going to go ahead and file on the 10th day. And they were doing this. We think that is sandbagging. We don't think that's fair. And we are more than willing to say, yeah, that's got to stop. So what we did is we came up with the language that you have in front of you, which says when the plaintiff makes the demand or their attorney, they have to provide the documentation when they make the demand. And if they receive additional documentation from when they make the demand up until it's time to file, they have to provide that documentation. When they receive it, they've got to get it right over there. There was a concern raised by the opponents to this bill that additional trials would be needed to resolve these issues about whether or not the plaintiff sent enough documentation, whether or not it was complete, therefore whether they were entitled to attorney's fees. I'm here to tell the committee that is simply not the case. We already have hearings to determine whether or not there will be attorney's fees awarded, and are they reasonable? Is the amount that the plaintiff's attorney is asking for, is it a reasonable amount under the circumstances of that case? We already have these hearings. There's no additional trial. There's no additional hearing that would be required by the adoption of 306A. There's only one additional question that the judge would even have to consider. They would simply have to say, were all the documents that were in the plaintiff's control supplied? And if did they receive subsequent documents, did they supply them? If they didn't, they don't get attorney's fees. And the judge still will decide whether or not the amount claimed for attorney's fees is reasonable, because they always do that now, and they will continue to do that under this bill. So we think, along with OADC, we think that this is a good compromise. We think we've improved the bill. And the trade-off for expanding the number of days and providing for pre-filing, by the way, Oregon doesn't have pre-filing discovery as a general rule. There's a specific exemption. This statute means that we now have pre-filing discovery. You got to provide the information before you file the lawsuit if you expect to benefit from this statute. So this is a big change in terms of what plaintiffs and plaintiff's attorneys are going to be required to do. Finally, we think a fair trade-off is to raise the amount. One of the arguments against this bill is that one of the insurance companies has said that 95% of the cases that they handle will be covered by this statute. Our response is good, because these statutes cause these cases to settle, and it lessens the number of cases that are filed. It lessens the number of cases that have to go to court and be tried. So the more cases that we can cover, the better it is, because more cases will settle, and it will lessen the pressure on the judicial system. So for these reasons, we ask you to support this bill. I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Crawford from the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, if I could.
Thank you, Representative Barker. Committee members, I am a member of OADC, and here on their behalf, just to go along and perhaps further and perhaps answer your question, Representative Barker, dealing with when is something filed. As a rule, plaintiffs are not going to file a 2080 letter until there is completion of the injury sustained. They've returned to medical stationary. That allows for an efficient practice on the plaintiff's behalf and also for representing the claimant. I'm also an arbitrator. I hear attorney fee questions all the time in the course of what I do as an arbitrator, and I believe Mr. Nelson will also hear these and be able to opine on this. It is an hour hearing at max. We receive documents. We receive affidavits. We know what went on from looking in the records, whether or not they've now complied or a plaintiff would have complied with the pre-discovery, that is, production of a fair package to be able to make a decision whether or not attorney fees or some part of attorney fees should be awarded. So it is something that OADC has agreed with. They've looked at the fact that for once, you're going to receive documents that support the claim, and that continuing duty is very, very important, because I can tell you, people are going to look at that. If you sandbagged and didn't produce the documents, you're not going to get your attorney fees on it. But it will aid, I think, in producing resolution on these type of cases. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Barker and committee members, for this opportunity. I did testify previously, as the senator mentioned.
Identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm James Nelson. I'm sorry. This bill has improved since it started, and it has resulted in a very fair compromise on a number of issues. The most significant thing is this will reduce litigation. And for 12 years, I was an insurance defense attorney. I represented one of the largest insurance companies in America and dozens of other smaller insurance companies and some self-insured corporations. I handled thousands of personal injury cases for insurance companies and corporations defending them. After doing that for 12 years, I switched my practice, and I now represent and have for many years primarily individual citizens like members of your various districts, handling claims that involve property damage, injury claims, product liability, fire losses, things of that nature. And I can tell you, as being a member kind of on both sides of this, this statute that's been in place for apparently about 60 years in Oregon reduces litigation. It forces plaintiffs to be reasonable. It forces insurance companies to be reasonable and focus on these smaller claims that can clog our court system. And the issue of attorney fees will only arise if both sides don't agree that the offer has been reasonable and that the claim has been reasonable. So it's going to really not even get to that point of judges or arbitrators deciding attorney fees, because the claims are just never going to get there. Most insurance companies have well-trained adjusters, and they fairly try to settle claims. Many of the companies and some of that are mentioned in the submissions to this are generally very fair companies. Unfortunately, not all companies are fair, not all adjusters are fair in the way the system works. A claims adjuster gets gold stars on the performance review if they settle claims cheaply. Now, cheaply is higher on the priority than fairly sometimes, and that's the problem. So years ago, our predecessors figured that we've got to do something with small claims. We've got to reduce litigation. We have to force both sides to focus on the issue, especially in these small claims, and keep them out of the court system. This statute will do that. I've seen it from both sides, and with the budgetary concerns and the our courts are clogged as it is now, this will reduce litigation, keep matters simple, and be a benefit, I think, to both sides, because the insurance companies have to pay attorneys if these things get into litigation, and it clogs the docket. And with the criminal cases giving priority, these things get pushed down the docket, and citizens can wait for years to even get a small claim resolved. So it's a very good bill.
My name is Erica Glazer. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee, for allowing me to speak. I started my practice as a plaintiff's attorney, and then I spent 7.5 years as in-house counsel for Farmers Insurance. So I was defending these types of 20.080 cases on a regular basis. And I'm here just to tell you that, and for the past 4 years I've been representing plaintiffs, I'm here to tell you that adjusters at insurance companies do pay more attention when they receive a 20.080 demand than they would for a similar lawsuit with a similar amount in the prayer. And it's because of the risk of having to pay the attorney fees to the plaintiff's attorney. It doesn't take an adjuster any longer to evaluate a 20.80 claim than it would a regular claim. So we're not putting any additional burdens on the adjusters or the insurance companies. In fact, doubling the amount of time for case evaluation, which this new bill does, allows them to better evaluate and give a fair amount as a tender to the plaintiff's attorney. It keeps this bill, like everybody has said, keeps cases that don't need to be in the court system outside of the court system. Because a small claim these days, essentially, 5,500, 10 years ago maybe that worked, but today I have clients, they get an MRI. One MRI is $2,000. That already puts them pretty much very well into that $5,500 amount. And this just kind of keeps pace with inflation, keeps a small case, which today would be about $10,000. I just urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 306A. As an attorney who has worked both sides, the defense side and the plaintiff side, and I think it's a bill, it's a statute that works, and we want to keep it working for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative
Spear. Chair. I think, Neil, this is for you.
Okay.
You mentioned in your testimony that the current system is occasionally abused by a few bad actors. Obviously, they're a small minority, but I'm wondering if there's, under this bill, what would happen if if those same few lawyers tried to sandbag the system under this bill? What if they, for example, made a demand under the statute knowing that they had only some of the documentation in their possession, but that there was more probably going to be coming that would support the claim, but they don't provide that and don't have to because it's not in their possession? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Representative Garrett, since Mr. Crawford indicated, since the arbitrators and the judges are going to have to decide, I never underestimate the tenaciousness of the defense bar. And I would tell you that I know that they would be very, very sure to obtain information to find out what was available to the plaintiff at what time. I don't think, and I'm not the judge, I'll be arguing one side or the other of this in the future if it passes, but I do not think that the defense bar is going to sit back and let a plaintiff just ask for it. Let's, example, plaintiff's going to a chiropractor and going to a licensed massage therapist, and it's a small injury case and it comes within the statute. Plaintiff's attorney just asks for the chiropractor's records and doesn't ask for the licensed massage therapist's records. Well, when you get it, so they file. Right? Can't settle it. File. You get into it, they have to provide discovery from every care provider that's been provided. Now, defense attorney is going to find out the plaintiff's attorney didn't ask for the LMT records. And when they start arguing about attorney's fees, defense attorney is going to say, excuse me, you're telling me you didn't know that your client was going to two care providers? Judge, they shouldn't get attorney's fees because what they did is they withheld documents readily available. They could have given it to us when they sent the demand. Don't give them attorney's fees. And I posit to you, that's what's going to happen. And it's not, I don't think a judge is going to say you get part of your attorney. The judge is going to say you don't get attorney's fees. The statute says you give them everything, and if you find stuff later, you give it to them. And if you don't, they can't evaluate it. You don't get attorney's fees. That's what I see happening under this bill.
Any questions, Representative Barton?
A comment, if I may, Mr. Chair. I found, at least in the practice of some, that in fact, you actually, the prevailing attorney, or the prevailing plaintiff's attorney doesn't even get full fees recompense, usually half or two-thirds or some fraction, if the judge concludes that your fees are disproportionate, as sometimes happens, I'm told.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on that. Mr. Jackson, in your written testimony, you say, for example, a consumer has reduced their legitimate 8,900 claim to 5,500 because they do not show them not obtain a net recovery of less than $5,500. So give me some numbers here, if you could, please. Representative Barton just said that attorneys are going to get, you know, if the person right now, or the system we have now, if he claims $5,500, is the attorney fees on top of that?
Yes. Yes, Representative Barker.
Give me some numbers so I can see how this...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisnett, I can give you some examples. They are anecdotal from my own practice, if that's okay.
Thank you.
I filed 12 of these cases since January. 11 of those cases have settled. The highest prayer in one of those cases was $5,500. The attorney's fees in that particular case, these are obviously smaller cases, but the attorney's fees in that particular case, as I recall, was between $2,500 and $3,000. And that file, I happened to notice that I had been carrying that file for a year and just hadn't been able to get it moving until now. It is true that on occasion, if the case does not settle beforehand and a lawsuit is filed and you go through arbitration, it is appealed by one side or the other, it goes in front of a court, it goes to the courthouse, it goes in front of a jury trial, you still, when you're done with that, you still have to go in front of the judge and ask the judge to make a determination. Are attorney's fees awardable here, and how much should be awarded? It is true. I had a case 2 years ago where the prayer was, it was $5,500 because my client reduced their claim. And the total attorney's fees on that particular case was about $6,300, as I recall. I'm not saying that my charges are representative. I'm just saying that on this particular type of case, those are some examples. It is possible that you can have a $5,500 case and the attorney's fees, by the time they're all done, they could be $10,000, they could be $20,000. I'm not going to tell you it's not. One of the things that you need to be aware of is that sometimes the amount of the fees that are awarded are controlled by the defense. Because if they take a particularly aggressive tack in defending these cases, the plaintiff's attorney is going to have to work that much harder and that much longer in order to prevail. So they can get skewered, and on occasion they do. Does that kind of answer your question, Representative?
Follow up. Thank you. Okay, So I sue. I had an injury, and I want it reimbursed for $5,500. Okay, and that falls under the guidelines right now.
Correct.
So, and you're representing me, and your claim is, and your attorney fees are $6,300. Okay. The judge can say that's fair, and we win. You have to win, right?
Right.
Okay. If you lose, you don't get anything.
Right. Neither the attorney nor the plaintiff.
So we win. So. The judge looks at that and says, this case, yeah, went several days, weeks, whatever, and says, that's fair. And that's so you would get the defendant has to pay you the $6,300 on top of the $5,500.
Chairman Barker, Representative Wisnick, yes.
And we're just raising that bar.
In that scenario, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Nelson. In your testimony, I was noticing that the... looks like the statute started in 1955 and was a $500 limit, and then was raised, based on testimony we've heard, to up to $5,500 over that next 44-year period.
Those are the figures that I've been able to find, Representative, yes.
Okay, so
in the 1950s, it was $500, and it's been raised... It's been raised since then. I can't tell you $500 was the original bill. I didn't go back that far. I was 3 years old at the time, so it's.
Thank you. I just, you know, if it took us 44 years to raise it $5,000, and now we're raising it $4,500 in 10 years, that seems like a pretty big increase. That'd be my only comment.
Yeah, figures are. The original $500, if you just upped it by inflation, would be over $35,000 or $38,000 now, just by inflation. Medical costs, of course, those costs have exceeded general inflation in our economy by a factor of 2 or 3 in the last 10 years anyway. So, you know, this doesn't even come close to keeping up with the realities of the bills that we see in cases. And so it's a well-needed update of a very effective statute of reducing litigation. This keeps cases from getting filed. It's a rare case that does get filed. And I think you mark on your calendar, and a few times you can find the Oregon Trial Lawyers and the OADC, and I've been members of both groups over the years, agreeing on a bill, too. That tells you something.
Mr. Chair. Anybody can answer this on the panel. The original bill that was submitted did not have Section 3 in it, what the engrossed version has now. Can you kind of explain the difference, 3s without the 3?
Neil Jackson speaking. Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson. I believe Senator Bonamici touched on that early in her testimony. Originally, as proposed, the only thing this bill did was raise the maximum amount that could be claimed to $10,000. There were no other changes. Representative Bonamici had a parallel bill she was introducing on behalf of a constituent to cover ORS 20082, which is the next statute in the book, which covers contract actions, small contract actions. Currently, that is a 10-day demand set at $5,500 also. And she asked that her Section 3, which covers the smaller contract action, be added to Senate Bill 306, and it was added, and that's how it got in there. Section 3 covers the contract actions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt, the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. I believe JL had to leave for an appointment.
Okay.
I'll just give some brief comments. We're in opposition to the bill as it now stands. It has improved since it was first introduced, but our view would be that the bill needs a little bit more work. The proponents said very clearly that the bill as it stands will encompass more cases, and from our point of view, that means more claims. More costs as a practical matter, whether it's on your homeowner's insurance and mine or on business liability insurance. These tend to be claims for things like slip and falls and things of that nature. So raising the limit at this point quite clearly will increase costs by all accounts. And so we would suggest some additional sideboards on these sorts of claims. One, while we think 20 days is a step in the right direction, we'd like to see a longer time frame on the production of the records and notice. Just keep bearing in mind that if someone does have an injury, there's going to be time for follow-up and obtaining those records. Secondly, we think ultimately that the best place to judge the awarding of the fees ought to be with the judge who may oversee the case, and we'd like to see some criteria in the bill on that. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. I think you're going to be hearing from a more technical panel on legal issues in a minute.
As between the version that 306A are engrossed and as the law now stands, which would you prefer?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, I think the bill as it stands is a slight improvement, but we would like to see some further improvement.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Powell, Catherine Morton, and John Clements.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, before you today, representing the Liberty Mutual group of insurers. My prayer recently has not been for dollars. It's been for an attorney who's active in this area, and it was answered today. So with me is Catherine Morton, who is also with the Liberty Mutual Group, and John Clements, who is a claims consultant with Safeco Insurance Company, which is also now part of the Liberty Group of Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, got several things that I could say from the previous testimony, but rather than confuse the issue, I would like to turn it over to Catherine and let her discuss this issue, including the Quigley case, which has just been mentioned. It's a 2008 Supreme Court case.
Chairman Barker, my name is Catherine Morton. I am with the Field Legal Group for the Liberty Mutual Companies. I've been practicing as a defense attorney in the state for 20 years now, and I'm here in opposition to this bill. First of all, there was basically the Quigley versus Powers versus Quigley case tilted the universe off of its axis last December when it was decided by the Supreme Court. In that decision, the Supreme Court took a case which was a ORS 2080 case, and the defendant had offered an amount of money after the case had been filed and did so in an offer of judgment. Prior to this decision, it was our understanding, it was actual practice in this state, that if a defendant made an offer of judgment and they turned out to offer more than was ultimately awarded, that the attorney's fees were cut off from that point of the offer of judgment forward until the culmination of the case. After Quigley, the Supreme Court decided that if you meet the technical requirements of ORS 2080, you make the demand 10 days before filing, and a offer that meets that demand is not made during that time frame, that attorney's fees will be awarded, and now they'll be awarded forever. Once you're on the train, you're forever on the train, paying attorney's fees until the plaintiff's attorney decides that he's earned enough attorney's fees for that case, regardless of what the defendant does. This is important because by nature of an offer of judgment, it means that the defendant offered more than the plaintiff ultimately recovered in the decision of the case. That means that the plaintiff's best interest and best recovery was not actualized. Instead, an award was made for less than that amount. So you have an inherent conflict of interest between the attorney who's there to earn attorney fees and the plaintiff who's there to have quick, speedy, efficient resolution of his case. So when we have 2080 cases, once you get on the train, you're forever on the train to the expense of attorney's fees, and there's no provision within the proposed amendments to 2080 that deals with that issue. 2080 increasing the amount to $10,000, obviously you'll hear later, increases the pool of cases that are potentially going to be impacted. If we step back and we think about what the purpose of this bill was, and that was to get a quick, efficient resolution for the claimant, by the change that happened as a result of the Quigley case and by some of the things that could happen as a result of this case, we're really not incentivizing that resolution if you don't provide some provision, even after the filing, that allows for the pendulum to shift to the other side, the risk to be borne by the other side instead of always being borne by the defendant in this particular case. I think that you have a risk here, and we talked about some of those bad apples in prior testimony, that somebody who has a true interest that may not be in quick resolution of early filing without full development of the case, because that way you don't have all of the information out and available for the evaluation by the defendant during the 20-day time period provided in this bill. We also have a situation where maybe they provide the medical records and information for the subject accident, but they don't provide the medical records and information for an ongoing injury or condition that they've had that preexisted the event that gives rise to the lawsuit. There are all sorts of questions that are left unanswered, left unclarified by the language that is currently being proposed that invites litigation up through the appellate courts that about this issue. And I think that here, under the current version of 2080, we have at least a cap on the amount of cases that would be subject to that, because it's only those 5,500 or lower. When you get to 10,000, your pool of places to have battles, normally outside of the court system, because these are all arbitration level cases, has been exponentially increased. As the battles increase, so do the attorney's fees and so do the cost to consumers in a ripple effect going forward. So for all of these reasons, I would urge your opposition.
Thank you, Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier witnesses pointed out we've had this statute for 60-some years, and they say it's worked well, and the defense bar has agreed with that. Do you agree that it's basically worked well? And I'm not trying to trap you, because my question would be, if you agree it's worked well, would you say that's because until the Quigley decision, we had the offer of judgment rule that could come in as part of a phase two, and Quigley has undone that? Is that your analysis?
Chairman Barker, Representative Garrett, yes, I would say that this was a fundamental shift in the way that ORS 2080 cases have taken place. It gave the defendant the opportunity to get the information, make a reasonable offer, and stop this situation where there is an inherent conflict between the plaintiff and their attorney whose motivation might be for increasing the attorney's fees. It allowed the risk to shift and for everybody to stop and make a decision even after the filing of the lawsuit.
So do you agree that before Quigley, this system worked pretty well?
Chairman Barker, Representative Garrett, yes, I do believe that it worked fairly well, in spite of the fact that there were those bad apples who didn't produce any information to allow the investigation, because there was this opportunity to stop. Yes.
Okay, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I'm going to have to leave after this, but I'm enjoying the discussion. So I gather, at least in your testimony, you made a few different points, but I would say the bulk of it was devoted towards essentially a critique of Quigley and how it is. You've further clarified how you believe that this process, on the whole, worked well, but Quigley very much undermined its effectiveness. That said, although I concede this bill is, at a minimum, related to Quigley, this bill is actually not directly related to it. For example, I mean, this Quigley came out in 08. I'm not aware of any bill that you have introduced or to address Quigley. I view that as a separate analytical issue that we can take up in another bill or the next legislative session.
Chairman, Representative Barton, I believe that the language of this bill had been formulated prior to the Quigley decision, and I'm speculating, hypothesizing that the language of the bill rested on the foundation that we all assumed was in place, that in fact there was an opportunity to stop the train. Since that time, I'm unaware of the work that has actually taken place between the various groups that have interest in this, but from the insurance company perspective and from the perspective of those of us who see this litigation all of the time, the risks associated with the ORS 2080 cases dramatically shifted to the defendant, and it took away any risk associated with a bad decision from the plaintiff. As such, I believe that it created a dynamic shift that had not been anticipated prior to the December 11, 2008 decision for Quigley.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. Before I suppose a comment. You assume that the proponents of this bill crafted this language or propounding this bill on the pre-Quigley body of law. That is an assumption I simply do not share. I think that is truly an assumption that is questionable. I also would like to state I support this bill as written right now. That said, I am willing in future legislative sessions to consider and take a look at Quigley and its effects and how it might intersect with this. But I don't view the questions and concerns surrounding the Quigley decision as being a roadblock to supporting this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr.
Chair, if I could respond. Yeah. Again, John Powell. Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, I was not aware of the Quigley case until the bill had already passed the Senate. And so at least I was unable to raise these issues, and I was dumbfounded by that case because, again, for clarity's sake, what Quigley said is the only offer that counts is that made within that time frame. It's currently 10 days after the letter of demand is received. This moves it to 20 days. Only the offer by the defense during that period of time counts as the best offer. So again, you can get that demand letter, the person can relapse or whatever, go back, start going back for medical treatment after that period. The lawsuit could be filed a year from now. And only during that period of time is the offer legitimate. And so I did not know that until after the bill had already passed.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, since I sat as counsel on the Senate side, we did have the idea from Drake Hood, who was from the Oregon Associated Defense Council, responding to the Quigley case in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he talked. That idea was to bring ORCP 54E, which I believe is the offer and judgment rule. That was part of the compromise that the OADC and OTLA went off and talked and then came back with these extended days and stuff that you bring in your notice. So, I mean, this was part of the discussion in the Senate side.
Representative Sigler.
And the, sort of a follow-up to that, that was, I guess, part of my assumption under the imposition under Section 1, I guess, sub 5, where there's the indication that plaintiff, I mean, there's a limitation on the ability to get attorney's fees when there's noncompliance with subsections 3 and 4. So, I mean, I think there's at least implicit in this some response to that set of circumstances.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Stiegler, I believe, though, and again, these are exceptions, not the norm, but we live in fear of the exception, and the exception somehow increases. If you envision yourself with a circumstance like I had last week, where an accident happened on April 9th, the complaint had been filed on April 20th and served and sued within that very short period of time. Even if you have strict compliance with the requirements of the statute, clearly you cannot provide the information necessary to evaluate that case if you file early, close to the time of the accident, because the plaintiff in that circumstance is not medically stationary. You have no idea what the nature, scope, or severity of the injuries are going to be during that time frame. I live and die by crafty practitioners, and I can see changes in practice that are in strict compliance but are not within the spirit of this measure in order to enhance the attorney's fees that would be recoverable.
Well, I get, and I don't want to get into a debate here with you, but I think the quote-unquote crafty aspect of this, I think, applies on both sides. I've witnessed plenty of craftiness on the parts of plaintiff's attorneys as well as defense attorneys. So
no question.
I have seen defense counsel who, you know, holds off and doesn't settle because they think that there's a ability to wear things down. So I guess, you know, the exception that everybody runs scared of, it's always out there. And I guess I would just applaud the OADC and OTLA for trying to come up with something that is as comprehensive as possible and takes as many circumstances into account.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, before I let Mr. Clements say something, I also want to address the Washington statute. It's my understanding that statute is a prevailing party statute. That is, the party that prevails receives attorney fees, which puts a totally different twist on how a statute like this would work rather than just being a one-way statute. The review of as many states as we could find, Alaska has a statute similar to ours. The cap is $1,000. In states that have higher caps, and we find very few of these statutes. In fact, looking around, they are prevailing party statutes, which gives both sides reason to be reasonable. Mr. Clements has handed out a handout with some of the data on the size of claims that would apply in this case. And I just turn it over to him. John, introduce yourself.
Yes, John Clements with Safeco Insurance Company, now part of the Liberty Mutual Group, and I've been handling claims for 29 years, 30 years in the insurance industry. And I'd like to say that a $10,000 claim is not a small claim. I heard mention of a $2,000 MRI. This $10,000 tends to typically be in addition to most medical bills, which are usually covered by PIP and subject to intercompany reimbursement. And so the $10,000 tends to be over and above medical bills. Insurance claims departments are motivated to settle small claims without this statute. Companies are also motivated to keep insurance affordable and available to the public as a whole. And at a time when I believe we're seeing a lot more people driving uninsured. Anything that will drive up the cost of insurance, I think, is generally not good for the insurance purchasing public as a whole and the public at large. Senate Bill 306 increases the cost of insurance because the only factors that triggers attorney fees is the threat of litigation and litigation itself. Without those factors, the bill just doesn't trigger anything. A modification from $5,500 to $10,000 is not justified. ORS 20.080 is very unique to this state. It's not seen in other states unless it has an equitable provision such as a prevailing party fee where the defendant has an equal chance to receive attorney fees as well. And finally, I believe that if an increase is passed, it should be significantly lower than $10,000. In fact, a small claims is currently defined as being $7,500 to qualify in small claims court actions. And so it doesn't seem like it would be reasonable to have at least two different definitions of what a small claims action is. With that, I'll entertain any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 306. Open a work session on Senate Bill 151.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 151 was heard by the committee a long time ago on March 13th. It allows the director of the Department of Human Services to appoint attorneys who can act as appointed personal representatives or file small estate affidavit for a decedent who received public assistance or received institutional care. It clarifies the attorney does not represent the director of DHS when appointed. We were waiting on this bill for a deal between DHS and the veterans. They came to an interagency agreement on some of the issues that this bill raised, and they have come to an agreement, so we were waiting for the House bills to clear out so we could schedule this. And at the hearing, we had testimony from Trisha Baxter from DHS and Paula Brown from Veterans Affairs. There is no amendment, there's no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Okay. We're talking about 151.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move Senate Bill 151 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 151 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Excuse.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krueger?
I'll vote aye, but what we reserve possible change on the floor.
Sure.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excused.
Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Does anybody want to like to hear that one?
I'll do it.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We open the public hearing on Senate Bill 389.
Senate Bill 389 repeals ORS 137-721, subsection 1, clarifies that if a person is convicted of possession of a substantial quantity of a controlled substance for delivery to a minor, the sentence is not limited to the presumptive 19-month sentence. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay.
Anybody? No one here.
Counsel, this conforms things to
yes.
Ballot Measure 57, right?
Yes.
That's the...
Nobody, we have no witnesses.
Consent
issue. Yeah. Council advised me this consent issue just merely
Do we know what reason? Oh, there's no.
There's nothing.
There's
no revenue, no fiscal.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westman.
I move Senate Bill
389. No, we're in a work session. We are in a work session already.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 389 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
I have to back up. I'm sorry. Open a work session on Senate Bill 389.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westman.
I move Senate Bill 389 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Sounds like an echo in here.
Thank you. We're doing fine until Shannon's here.
Yeah, that's right. Representative Westham moves Senate Bill 389 as amended to the floor to do pass. Is there any discussion on that? Representative Shields.
Council, one more time, could you tell us what we're doing with this bill?
Previously, prior to Measure 57, there was the possibility in, under certain circumstances, a judge could decide to downward depart on a sentence for a substantial quantity of methamphetamine delivery, things like that. All this does is conform that statute in light of Measure 57, which in certain circumstances does not allow for the discretion to downward depart. So it just removes the language that conflicts essentially with the statute that's in place.
Mr. Chair, wasn't some of that so they could get treatment, wasn't it? Wasn't that part of the conditions that it'd be in?
That wasn't the intent of what we did with 3638 or House Bill 3638. Actually, it was to try to get us up to speed with where we looked at for the Schedule II controlled substances.
So this would allow clarify that they could downward depart to probation.
No, this Measure 57 removed that discretion,
right.
And so this simply takes that out of the current statute because it no longer is essentially lawful.
So we're trying to get in compliance with Measure 57, but as the law stands right now, a judge might be able to argue that I could depart down to probation on these cases.
Measure 57 supersedes, so that's what's the current. That's the current state. We just have this provision in the statute that needs to be.
So there's not a conflict between the statute and the constitutional matter.
Exactly.
Okay.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Excused.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krueger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Vice Chair Siegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Do that consent.
Consent. If you have objective,
that's fine.
Okay, consent. Further business.
Well,
thank you. Committee meeting adjourned.